surgical palliative care may seem counterintuitive, but surgeons have a rich history of palliating both their patients and their families. I am Red Hoffman, an acute care surgeon in Asheville, North Carolina, and one of 79 surgeons currently board certified in hospice and palliative medicine. Join me as I interview the founders and the leaders of the surgical palliative care movement, a diverse group of surgeons dedicated to providing high-quality palliative medicine to all surgical and trauma patients. Welcome to the Surgical Palliative Care Podcast. We heal with more than steel. Hi, everyone. This is Red Hoffman. Thank you for joining me for another episode of the Surgical Palliative Care Podcast. Today, I am excited and honored to speak with Dr. Anne Mosenthal, whom I like to refer to as the mother of surgical palliative care. Anne has worked for the past 2+ decades to integrate palliative medicine into the care of all surgical patients. She was one of the original members of the American College of Surgeons Surgical Palliative Care Task Force and is now the chair of the Committee on Surgical Palliative Care. She has held multiple leadership positions within the American College of Surgeons, the American Association for the Surgery of Trauma, and the Society for Surgical Chairs. She is a prolific researcher and recently edited the book entitled Surgical Palliative Care. For the past 9 years, Anne served as professor and chair of the Department of Surgery at Rutgers, New Jersey Medical School. Of note, when she started this position, she was one of only 6 female surgical chairs in the United States. She recently transitioned to a new role as the chief academic officer at Lahey Hospital and Medical Center. Personally, Anne has served as my role model ever since I discovered that it was possible to combine my love of surgery with my love of palliative care. One of the things I admire most about her is that despite working in this field for over 20 years, she is still so visibly passionate and excited about making certain that all surgical patients receive the high-quality palliative care they deserve. Hi, Anne. Thank you.
Hi, Red. Thanks for having me and those lovely comments.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm so excited for you to be here. So, Anne, as we're getting started, can you share a little bit about yourself, where you grew up, where you trained, and why you decided to pursue a career in surgery?
Sure. So I grew up in mostly in New York City, but also in rural Connecticut, what I think of as the best of both worlds. And I went to school in New York. I actually went to an all-girls high school, which at the time I didn't think was so wonderful. But looking back, I think it was instrumental in a lot of my future career. And then I really wanted to be a veterinarian or a field biologist like Jane Goodall. So I went to Cornell. After a while, I thought that would be too lonely to be in the jungle. So I eventually switched gears. I decided late to become a physician and go to medical school. So I did research for a couple of years in microbiology, which really got me excited about the scientific process and inquiry, and I think that propelled a lot of my future work as well. So I went to medical school at Dartmouth, which is now called Geisel School of Medicine. I was one of those people, I thought I would do something in neuroscience, neurobiology, behavior, psychiatry, and so I did my surgery rotation first to get it out of the way because I was sure that I would hate it. Needless to say, that was not the case, and I was really excited about taking care of really sick patients and getting to look inside an abdomen, and I really loved it. So I eventually, after some soul searching, decided that surgery was the thing for me. I will say that we had one attending surgeon who was a woman. and she was married to the chair of cardiac surgery. So that was a little peculiar. And so there weren't a lot of role models. But there were a few residents in who were women. But I did have the sense that all the women were somewhat marginalized. They were usually one of a sea of men. And it was daunting. And when I started talking about it, the head of the surgery clerkship, you know, said, oh, well, if you're a woman in surgery, you should do plastic surgery, which I did a rotation in that, which I really didn't like at all. So, but nevertheless, I persevered and I matched at University of Massachusetts in surgery. And our intern class, there were 5 women.
Oh, wow.
Out of 8 categorical residents. So that had never before been seen. So that caused quite a stir. Out of those 5, only 2 of us finished as chief residents for varying reasons. And my friend Judy Pepe and I were, and we're still very close friends. We were chief residents together. So it's been very exciting. And my interest in really sick patients carried through, and I did a fellowship in surgical critical care. Then I moved to UMDNJ, which is now Rutgers, to start my career partially at the VA, doing some trauma surgery and general surgery in ICU. And I thought I would have the usual academic career doing basic science research in shock and gut immunology. And I think my experience as a trauma surgeon informed my interest in palliative care, because many patients die suddenly and we have to go out and tell a mother or father that their son or daughter died from a gunshot wound or a car accident. And this was a huge challenge for me, and I really felt unprepared. We had no training in it whatsoever. So that propelled me forward in thinking about how do we do this better. I guess I've answered more of your question than
That's okay. One, I think it's really interesting. I think you're the 3rd person that I've interviewed who said that they considered a career in psychiatry, which I think is fascinating, since I'm focusing on surgeons who are interested in surgery and palliative care. So I wonder, it's like an interesting connection. 2, I'm wondering if you can talk a little more about, so you certainly noticed this gap in your education or skill base around dealing with these critically ill or horribly injured patients. Who were your early mentors in learning about palliative care or communication skills, bad news, delivery, that sort of thing?
Yeah. So really, I think my earliest mentor was and still is a nurse, Pat Murphy, who is an amazing force of nature, wonderful nurse who went on and got her PhD in bereavement and ethics. And she was initially our bereavement specialist at our level 1 trauma center, and was always the person that we called when we had really challenging end-of-life situations to help us. And she really taught me about end-of-life care and how to talk to families and what's important from the family's perspective in giving bad news, how to be direct and honest, you know, how not to be afraid when people fall on the floor or faint or get angry. She's really amazing, amazing teacher and in all those ways. So she was really my first mentor and is still somebody that I turn to for those really difficult conversations. So she and I partnered together to write a grant to the Soros Foundation Project on Death in America on bringing palliative care to trauma patients. And that sort of introduced me to other people in the world of palliative care. So one really key person was and is Jeff Dunn, who was one of the first thinkers, I would say, in the last 20 years about surgical palliative care and that it's really a specialty within surgery. And he went on to found the Committee on Surgical Palliative Care and the Task Force in the American College of Surgeons. And he has been a great mentor for me and a partner in all of this work. And we did edit the book on surgical palliative care together last year. The other mentor who I think has been really important is Judy Nelson, who is actually a pulmonary critical care physician originally and is also a palliative care physician. I met her through the Project on Death in America, and we have really exchanged a lot of ideas, and she's done a lot of important work on palliative care in the ICU and the interdisciplinary nature and symptoms. So she's been an amazing mentor as well.
I actually met Pat Murphy. I actually sat behind her at an AHPM screening of Extremis that featured, I know, one of the people that she knew, Dr. Jessica Zitter. Yep. And I said, oh, I'm so excited to meet you. I know that you worked with Anne Mosenthal. And she corrected me, said, no, Anne Mosenthal worked with me. So I said, okay.
That's Pat.
Yeah.
Pat used to go, we would give talks together, and she would, you know, play on the old fashioned surgeon perspective of, oh, this is Pat, my nurse. He would say, this is Anne Mosenthal, she's my surgeon.
That's amazing. So can you talk a little bit about the early papers that you wrote with Pat Murphy about integrating palliative care into the trauma intensive care unit?
Yes, I can. So Pat and I went on after our initial work to have a Robert Wood Johnson Foundation grant on promoting excellence in end-of-life care. And we had this idea that, which we still have, and I think it's a really important fundamental to me on how to integrate, which is that the palliative care should be integrated into the care of patients in the surgical ICU or the trauma ICU. It should not be an added thing. So our model was to really bring the palliative care expertise into the ICU directly and bring the training and concepts, which is what's now called primary palliative care, into the practice of trauma surgeons and intensivists who otherwise may not think of it as part of what they do. So we created a sort of a communication bundle for our surgical ICU, which involved an initial palliative care assessment, which was done both by nurses and the physician, usually the residents. And it included a question, which was somewhat like the surprise question, a question of, did you think the patient would survive at a year? And we asked people to just sort of think about that in their mind, and we would ask that question on rounds. The purpose of which was just to get people to think about, oh, this patient might actually probably be dead in a year, in which case that might be reason to rethink their goals of care. And we had an assessment of the family within 24 hours of admission. And then we advocated that every patient who was in the surgical ICU, by definition, had a potentially 10 to 20% mortality risk statistically, and therefore they should have some kind of family meeting or goals of care discussion within 72 hours. So because we had grant funding, we were able to do this, and our model was using either advanced practice nurses or bereavement counselors as our liaisons to work with the physicians and the nurses in having family meetings. So that was our model, and we called it an integrated model. And when we studied it, which was our first papers, we really had a significant change in the length of stay for patients who died, much less non-beneficial life support. And we increased the amount of time in conversation about goals of care on rounds on a daily basis. So those were our early publications. And we did that not only with our trauma patients, but with liver transplant patients and the other general surgical patients. We also combined that with some educational program for both physicians and nursing to build some primary palliative care skills. So that was our model and continues to be the model that I think is really important for surgical patients and ICUs, rather than the let's all decide when to get a consult model, which works in some places. But if you don't have the bandwidth and the workforce to do palliative care, the primary palliative care, I think, is very doable and successful.
Did you get any pushback from any of the other surgeons, particularly, say, the transplant surgeons, when you were starting to discuss goals of care on their patients?
We did, some more than others. It was interesting because several of our transplant surgeons really, you know, on reflection, felt that these are conversations that they are frequently having, not necessarily with the post-transplant patients, but with patients who are not going to, you know, who are not going to get listed or not going to get a transplant. So they are really, to some degree, have expertise in difficult conversations. That said, the truth of it is that all transplant patients, once they're transplanted, you know, all the statistics and the quality metrics are measured for a year, so it's very, very challenging to help transplant surgeons think about earlier palliative care. So there was some resistance, but not as much as you would think. And I think that because there were several of our surgeons who were very engaged in communication and family support, it was a natural transition to learn how to better have these conversations.
So you've written a lot about, or some about, the idea of futility. And to me, I've struggled a lot with this word. It seems like a somewhat tricky word sometimes, and it seems like it can be somewhat subjective depending on who's defining it. So I'm wondering, how do you define that word, futility?
Wow, that's a great question. I think getting into global definitions of futility is not very helpful.
Okay.
Because we all will have a different idea of what that means. But I like, from a practical standpoint, I like to think of it as a given therapy is either a futile or not futile, depending on what the goal of the patient is. So rather than say, oh, you know, all care is futile for a given patient because they're going to die next week or next month or tomorrow, which is really not helpful because any caring is not futile, but rather to say, well, will this surgery help, you know, get the patient to their granddaughter's wedding or not? You know, will it cure the cancer? If that's the only thing, then no, it's not futile. But if it will cure the cancer but leave you dependent on the ventilator for the rest of your life, then maybe that is futile. So that's how I think about it. So you really need to understand what the goal of the therapy or the goal of the patient is in order to decide if a specific therapy or procedure or life support is futile or not.
That's such a good reminder. We actually talked about this in our M&M this morning. The idea of futility came up, and it did circle back to what are the goals of the patient. And sometimes there's that silence because the answer is, oh, I didn't really ask that, or I didn't think that I had time to ask that in the middle of the night. And there's always 5 or 10 minutes to pause and say, what are the goals? And can surgery or medical treatment or something else help us to achieve those goals? But taking the time to define those goals is sometimes challenging if you haven't been trained to do it.
Yeah. Agreed. It's hard.
It is. It's hard to find words. So I know you were chair of the Department of Surgery for almost a decade. And I'm wondering, what were some of the steps you took to further integrate palliative medicine into the culture of your surgical department?
Well, one was recruiting people that had the interest and wanted to pursue it in an academic and concrete fashion. So that was one. I think it really, to some degree, was changing the culture and you have to do that with sustained efforts, I learned. So I think bringing it into education and making it a priority and considering it and labeling it a skill rather than an extra thing that, you know, we have to convince people about, I think was part of my success. And I don't know that I was wholeheartedly successful. There were continued to be, you know, many divisions that didn't feel it was part of their practice. But I think where we were successful was in integrating it into the surgical training for residents, for our fellows, and expanding and collaborating with other specialties to bring it to medical students and continuing to write about it and speak about it. So I think having research opportunities and having robust education of communication skills as just part of our surgical training was an important step.
Do you have any practical tips for the residents and even for the attendings that are listening about how to deliver bad news to patients, some of the things that you utilize?
I think very practically is, you know, many of the procedures that are out there, such as spikes or vital, are good places to start. I think you need to be direct. Don't use a lot of words. You know, if you're delivering the news of death to a family member, I think you have to use the word dead. I learned this from Pat Murphy. Don't use euphemisms. Probably the most important is to fire a warning shot, which can be as simple as, I'm so sorry. You know, your son came in, we did everything we could, but he died. And then pause and wait for response. And really at that point, information is less important than responding to emotion. And that's really the hard part is sort of carrying the emotion and allowing it to exist. People will be emotional, obviously.
That was probably one of the biggest takeaways I got from fellowship was use the word dead. I was actually sometimes amazed when I'd shadow my program director how often he said it. And I definitely adopted that from him, just that it's only fair to the patient and their family to just be simple and truthful, coming from a place of love, of course.
Yeah, I think demonstrating that one cares is especially important. So the way, you know, the body language, ideally, you know, some people like to be touched, some people don't. But I think having a body language that expresses that you care and that you are sorry, even if you didn't know anybody, any of the people involved, is really important. So it's less about the information and the why and than it is about the caring.
And then another thing that comes up a lot, especially when I'm teaching medical students and residents, is how best to discuss code status with patients and families. And I know I've developed my own little talk that I give, and I'm wondering how you approach that talk.
I think you have to assess where people are and then meet them where they are. And I have learned by making mistakes that if you go into a meeting or a conversation with an agenda, one, they will pick up on it. And if that agenda is, oh, I got to get the DNR order, that doesn't work very well. So I think the really important is to first do an assessment of what people understand, whether it's the family or the patient, about the illness, about the trajectory, as a place to start, and then try to elicit some goals and preferences around end of life in the context of how severely ill the patient is, and then reframe. So it's a constant reframing of, well, I'm hearing that he is a person that would never want to live this way, or if he was in a nursing home, he wouldn't want to survive. So, you know, trying to reframe the assessment information that you get into a conversation that is that DNR is right for this patient. So I think listening for those cues is really important. So I think, yeah, and then, you know, make a recommendation. I think we often forget that it's not just up to the family or up to the patient. We can make a recommendation and we should make a recommendation. I have had situations where I've sensed as the conversation goes on that the family or the patient is not ready for that recommendation, and then I don't make it. So that's a little bit of the judgment.
I recently talked to Gretchen Schwarzy, and we were talking about using decision aids. We were talking about best case, worst case, and she was saying that it's often forgotten that along with using a decision aid, you need to elicit preferences and then again, make that recommendation that we need to filter this all through our doctor minds and our palliative care minds and spit out our best recommendation for that patient. Because without that, we're kind of just leaving it up to them and they're just kind of walking around in this jungle of ideas that they may not or likely don't have the educational or even emotional wherewithal to process.
Yeah.
I think a lot of times that's where we fall short or where people feel like we're breaching the idea of patient autonomy if we do that. Instead, I like to look at it like I'm relieving them of their decisional burden by just advising them. And I always say, this is just what I recommend. I'll do, I'm open and I'm happy to discuss more. And in the end, I'll likely do what you want, but I do want to give my best assessment of what I think's going on.
Yeah, I think that's really important to emphasize that it's a recommendation about this patient at this time, and it's not that you recommend everyone to be DNR. That whether or not they agree with your recommendation, you know, you're not abandoning the patient, you're still caring for the patient. And usually I try to emphasize that DNR means we're not going to resuscitate in the event of cardiac arrest. Doesn't mean we're not going to give pain medication. We're not going to continue vent support if that's appropriate. So I think that's important to separate all of those and leave the door open for further conversation if, you know, the meeting does not result in a conclusion.
Right. So, Anne, I know that you recently switched jobs. And this was right at the beginning of the COVID pandemic. So I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about your experiences in walking into this new position and whether you were called upon right away to use some of your palliative care skills, given the fact that we were in this pandemic and you were going into a place, Boston, that's hit by this pandemic pretty hard.
Yeah, so it's been quite an experience. I did start in the middle, really at the beginning of the pandemic here in Massachusetts, which was not planned, obviously. So I was not seeing patients, but very quickly, I think my expertise in ethics and palliative care became very useful. I mean, my first challenge was that you can't meet people. So a lot of things were on the phone and or Zoom kinds of meetings. But I did get involved in a couple of initiatives. So one was our organization, our health system, set up a group to develop our crisis standards policy should the time arise that we did not have enough ventilators or enough people to take care of everybody. That was really fascinating in thinking about how would we make this terrible decision. So I was a member of the allocation team. Fortunately, we were never called upon to make any of these decisions, but we were able to develop a process of what we thought was the best possible way, given our ability, very limited ability to prognosticate, both for COVID or really for any critically ill person. And then the other area that, you know, we really saw a gap in our ICU, we pretty much virtually doubled the number of ICU patients than we normally have here and had a really huge surge deployment of many physicians, advanced practice providers, and nurses who do not normally do critical care. So I was involved with some training. It's kind of just-in-time training. And then what was the biggest challenge that we all faced was that families could not be in the hospital to see their loved ones in the ICU. So we set up what I think was an innovative program of communication liaisons, where we had physicians who were not intensivists or critical care specialists who were trained in communication skills as the liaison to the family, between the family and the ICU team and the palliative care team. So our palliative care team really was very involved in the training, and this served as physicians who were extension of both palliative care and ICU. It was very, very successful, and we're just now gathering our data about, you know, what the families thought of it, as well as what the liaisons themselves. But I think for many, it was really eye-opening to have these incredibly meaningful conversations and help families feel connected to their loved one while they're in the ICU. So I'm really proud of what we were able to set up. So that's where we are today.
What are you doing in your new role?
My new role is mostly focused on developing the academic missions at Leahy, both education and research. So I am trying to set up some of my own continuation of my own research and initiatives in integrating palliative care into ICU care and surgical specialties. We have a lot of geriatric surgery here, and hoping as well as geriatric trauma to start to work on that. We are actually doing a study on the impact of COVID on end of life care practice in the ICU, which, you know, had varying levels of acceptance. And I think the COVID brought a new respect, and more people were embracing, in terms of practitioners, embracing end-of-life care. So we're looking at that. And I am also really turning a lot of attention to our educational programs as well. So there's lots to do.
And then looking forward, what do you feel are the top priorities for surgical palliative care in the next decade?
I think the top priority is to continue to expand the concept of surgical palliative care as primary palliative care, that it is a subspecialty of surgery, that it is part of what many, many surgeons do in practice. And we need to accept that and integrate it into our practices as time goes on. So that means that, how do we do that? That means standard curriculum in all surgical training where it's relevant. And it also means bringing it into all of our quality measures, our quality programs, particularly in the American College of Surgeons. So I think it's a top priority to integrate palliative care across NISQIP, TQIP, all the quality improvement programs, so that it's a core part of something that we measure, that we have standards for it, and that we hold our various, you know, whether it's a trauma center or a geriatric surgery center or general surgery, that we hold our centers accountable for meeting those standards in particular ways. I think that's the next phase, to really drive the incorporation of palliative care into our practice.
My hope, too, is to really empower surgeons that they can do this, that you don't need to do a fellowship in order to learn these skills, and that you don't need to have fellowship training to realize when someone is appropriate for hospice, or when someone is imminently dying, or when someone needs to have a goals of care discussion, that you can do this. Because I think the default oftentimes is consult palliative care, but the reality is there's not enough palliative care providers, and palliative care providers are not available 24/7. So we need to be doing this.
I agree. I think, and we are the right people to do it. I think that myth of, well, we go off and do surgery and procedures, that's what we're good at, and we're bad communicators, is a myth that we need to get rid of. And we're the only ones that understand a lot of the outcomes and the issues that palliative care specialists don't necessarily don't necessarily understand. So I agree. I think it is our responsibility and our, and we are perfectly able to do it and do it well.
Yeah.
With the right training.
Well, Anne, thank you so much for your time. I just have to say out loud that I feel like I honestly wouldn't have the career I have or the opportunities I have if you had not blazed the trail before me. And I just have the utmost love and respect for you. I just think you're amazing. And I'm grateful for all you've taught me and just grateful for all the work you do in this world. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure. Enjoyed speaking with you. And I think you should do this for a living. You're a very good interviewer.
Thank you. This is my retirement plan.
Oh my God.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Surgical Palliative Care Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to stay up to date on the latest episodes. To learn more about the surgical palliative care community, follow us on Twitter at SurgePalCare. If you'd like to get more involved with the Surgical Palliative Care social media team, please reach out on Twitter or via email at surgicalpalliativecare@gmail.com. Lastly, take good care of yourselves and take good care of each other.